There's a whole other chorus, but you know, there it is. But that's what I wanted to try to sing about it, because I want to talk about it, and that is this idea of identity. And Newt's been talking about that, you know, in a way that, I don't know about you, it's like he's defragmenting my gospel hard drive. And you know, we need to keep hearing the gospel, and he's been blowing my mind, and so I'm thankful for that brother. So let's talk about Matthew and his world. Like Mark, Matthew's written at a time when there's a conflict. Mark, we know, was written at sometime after 64, after the fire, and his first readers are suffering persecution. Well, something similar to that's going on in Matthew. Matthew's the Gospel of Galilee. He talks about Galilee more than any of the other Gospel writers. And you do know that none of the Gospels are signed and none of the Gospels are dated. It's not like Paul's letters are signed and it's, you know, to Ephesus or to Thessalonica or something like that. And so a lot of what I'm doing is reconstructing and work based on work that other people have done. But we're fairly certain Matthew is giving leadership to a group of churches in the Galilee. And around 66, when the revolt starts, up to 70, and when Jerusalem is destroyed, what you need to know is that, we talked about this our first time together, Judaism is becoming one thing. In Matthew's time, and part of becoming one thing means getting the Christians out, and so that's the time. We'll talk more about that in a second. We know virtually nothing about Matthew. All that we know about him, we know from chapter 9 of his gospel, where we read that he's sitting at the tax table, and Jesus comes up with that authoritative, absolute lordship, and says, "Follow me," and he stands up and walks away, probably from more wealth than all of the rest of the disciples put together, because he was in charge of other tax collectors. And interesting, we know that the tax collectors were bad guys. We know that in the Talmud they are grouped with murderers and adulterers. But oddly enough, we don't have lots of complaints against tax collectors in the ancient literature. The most interesting piece we have, I think, from the Gospels is when the tax collectors come to John the Baptist and say, "What should we do?" Remember what John told them: stop charging more or taking more than you're authorized to take. And so that's a little window that we have into Matthew. He's apparently there in Capernaum. And we know that Matthew's not his name. You know his name. What's his name? Levi. Very Jewish, good Jewish name. His brother James is a disciple, so we've got three sets of brothers that are disciples. Six of the 12, half of Jesus' disciples are brothers. Matthew is described as the son of Alphaeus, and James is also described as the son of Alphaeus, so that's where I'm getting that from. What I do with the other Gospels is harder to do with Matthew, and that is engaging with the life situation and who he is and his languages and that sort of thing. But I've been thinking about it and had a new idea just as I was driving up here. So I'm really excited about this. I hope it's true, but it's a really cool idea. You know, my academic reason is I really want it to be true. What I realized is that Matthew is the perfect person to write a gospel to a group of Christians who are being kicked out of Judaism, because he's a tax collector. He knows what it's like to be kicked out of the synagogue. So isn't that cool? Come on. Give me a little love. I think it's a very cool idea. Yeah, so thank you. Thank you. Card. Affirmation junkie. So he's writing to Christians. Judaism is becoming one thing. And remember the first question the church had to deal with in Acts. The first question the church had to deal with, can you even be a Christian and not be a Jew? Right? That was a very real question. You got to be circumcised in order to become a Christian? And it was this big revelation. No, you don't have to do that. You can maintain your Gentile identity. You don't have to become a Jew. And so Matthew, that's the world we're still in. And if we're going to understand his gospel, we got to look at that world. And so the Christians are very much still a part of the synagogue, and they are suffering as the tension leads up to the rebellion in 66 that ends in 70. They're suffering right along with the Christians, I mean with the Jews. In 40, I don't know if you remember this, but Caligula, who was the craziest of all Roman emperors, Caligula ordered that a statue of him be put up in the Holy of Holies in the temple in Jerusalem. You can imagine how that went over, okay? And when the protest started, the Christians were protesting that right along, the Christian Jews were protesting that right along with their brothers and sisters. In 41, when Claudius, because Caligula's gone, Claudius writes what's called the writ of temperance. We're gonna put up with the Jews. That included Jewish Christians as well. So we're right 40, 41 of 52. When Claudius kicks all the Jews out of Rome, he kicks the Jewish Christians out of Rome too. That's Priscilla and Aquila. So we're suffering. We're still in the synagogue. We are still part of that community. And I'm making a big deal out of this because Matthew, that's who Matthew is writing to. He's writing to this group that's being kicked out of the synagogue, okay? And so what happened was, right around 70, actually right after 70, when Judaism was being reformed, and becoming one thing, rabbinic Judaism that we know today, a group of rabbinic leaders got together in a little town called Yavne, which is on the coast, and they decided, this is how we're going to get the Christians out. We're going to set up a synagogue service that will exclude them, okay? And we came up with what are called the 18 benedictions. In Hebrew, it's called the Amidah, A-M-I-D-A, and that means stand up. And because this new innovation was, because we're not really even sure what the synagogue service was like in Jesus' day. We know that Jesus read from the scroll, so there was, you know, reading, but we're not exactly sure what the synagogue was. Actually, nobody's really sure when the synagogue started, which I think is an interesting thing. It's a Greek word, right? So they come up with the 18 benedictions, and what these are blessings. We're going to stand up together. Some of these blessings we've been reciting together in the synagogue, but we're going to edit them together, and we're going to add one. Number 12. Let me read the first benediction to you, and imagine us all together in the synagogue with our brother Jewish believers, and we say this: O Lord, open my lips, and my mouth shall declare your praise. Blessed art thou, O Lord our God, God of the fathers, God of Abraham, God of Isaac, God of Jacob, the great and mighty God, the most high God, who bestows chesed and is the master of all things, who remembers the pious deeds of the patriarchs, and in love will bring a redeemer to their children's children for your name's sake. Can you say amen to that? Okay, they still read this in synagogue every Shabbat. That's number one. That's the first benediction. We stand up and we recite that together. If I got any more. No, that's the only one I've got. Here's number 12, though. So we're all together with our brothers, and all of a sudden, this is the new benediction that we have to recite together. For the apostates, let there be no hope. That doesn't sound like a benediction, does it? And let the arrogant government, Rome, be speedily uprooted in our days. Let the Nazarenes, that's us, and the Minim means heretic, and the heretics be destroyed in a moment, and let them be blotted out of the book of life and not be inscribed with the righteous. Blessed art thou, O Lord, who humbles the proud. Now, we can't recite that, can we? Because we would be cursing ourselves, and it was believed that no one would curse themselves. And so in this new synagogue setting leading up to 70 AD, this is how, or at least one way, that Christian Jews were kicked out of the synagogue. And I'm making a big deal out of that because that is the first readership of the Gospel of Matthew. And if you're a Jew and you're kicked out of a Jewish home, it still happens if you're a Jewish person, you embrace Jesus, you still get kicked out, you know, for the most part. The son of the synagogue, of the Orthodox synagogue leader in Nashville, Rabbi Posner was the chief rabbi, and his son Mendel became a Christian, And he heard there was this guy who wrote the song El Shaddai that had Hebrew in it, so he wanted to meet with me. So I said, sure. So I sit down with Mendel. Mendel's about 18 years old. And I thought we're going to meet. We didn't meet. He sat and cried. Because he had not just been kicked out of a building, he'd been kicked out of Jewish life. And those are the first readers of the Gospel of Matthew. They don't know who they are anymore. You know, if you're a Jewish person and you're excluded from Judaism, you don't know who, because that's your identity, right? Okay, so I've beat that horse to death, haven't I? That lets you know why Matthew's central theme is the kingdom. Matthew's good news is you are not disenfranchised. You are part of a kingdom, and guess who the king is? Jesus. That's why kingdom is so important in Matthew's gospel. That's why only in Matthew's gospel does Jesus say, you're the light of the world. Now in John, he says he is, and he is. But in Matthew remembered that Jesus also said that we are the light of the world. Matthew's telling us who we are because we don't know who we are anymore. Only in Matthew does Jesus say, you are the salt of the earth. See, that's a unique, and if you're really listening to Matthew, that's part of the uniqueness of Matthew, and I've got a big long list of these things, and I will not do that to you right now. But what I want to do is look at two segments of Matthew's gospel and listen to the detail and see what's going on. Okay, is that cool? You good with that? Not a lot of energy coming back. my wife says, you're an affirmation junkie. Will it ever be enough for you? And I say, no. Well, if I hear, well done, thou good and faithful, that might be enough even for me, right? Okay, the first thing I want to look at in terms of detail are the two feedings, the feeding of 5,000, the feeding of 4,000. I'm fascinated, and one of my lists that I'll share with you later is all the twin incidents in the Gospels, two sendings, two confessions of Peter, two storms on the Sea of Galilee. I mean, I think I've got 11 twin incidents, and I've been trying to find some answers for this. In the rabbinic literature, they twin stories because one story will interpret another story. I don't know if that works in the Gospels, but I want to share the two miraculous feedings. But I want you to know that the details are what allow you to understand these stories. And we haven't listened, most of us haven't listened closely enough to the details. So let me just read it to you. This is Matthew 15, verse 29. And I think this is the only miracle that's in all four Gospels. Jesus left there and went along the Sea of Galilee. Then he went upon a mountainside and sat down. We have a vague idea of where this is. They built a big church there. Now, great crowds came to him, bringing the lame, the blind, and the crippled, the mute, and many others, and they laid him at his feet, and he healed them. The people were amazed when they saw the mute speaking, the crippled made well, the lame walking, and the blind seeing, and they praised God, not Jesus. Now, that's important, y'all. Jesus heals people, and they don't praise him. They praise God. And I think that lets me understand his countenance or his attitude. He is always winning praise for the Father. That's a big deal. That's a detail, but I'll make a big deal out of that. Jesus called his disciple to him and he said, I have compassion for these people. They've already been with me 3 days and have nothing to eat. I meant to do the 5,000 first, but we're good. I do not want to send them away hungry, or they may collapse along the way. His disciples answered, where could we get enough bread in this remote place to feed such a crowd? How many loaves do you have? Jesus asked. 7, they replied, and a few fish. He told the crowd to sit down on the ground, and he took the loaves and fish, and when he'd given thanks, he broke them and gave them to the disciples. Did you miss it? The miracle just happened. What did he do? He said the blessing. Okay, no lightning bolts from his fingertips. Unmiraculous miracle, but a pretty cool miracle. They all ate and were satisfied. Afterward, the disciples picked up 7 baskets full. and the detail that you need to understand about the two feedings is the word for baskets. Now, in the translation that I worked on, the CSB, we used large basket here because there are two different baskets, and that's what makes all the difference, okay? In the second feeding, the feeding of the 4,000, they pick up seven spheros. Spheros is a rope basket. It's a man-sized basket. It's the basket that was used to let Paul over the wall. Okay? Remember, he was in a basket. Well, he was in a spheros. And after the feeding of the 4,000, they collected seven basketfuls. And that speaks of abundance. Okay, so the miracle behind the miracle of the feeding of the 4,000 is abundance. Let's go back now and look at the feeding of the 5,000, which I meant to do first. That's 14:13. When Jesus heard what had happened, John the Baptist, his cousin, John, you know, is his first cousin, has died, and he goes into the wilderness to try to, I think, mourn or cope with it. And he goes to get away from the crowd, and he turns around, and there's 5,000 people there. So it doesn't work very well. When Jesus heard what had happened, he withdrew by boat privately to a solitary place. Hearing this, the crowds followed him on foot from the towns. When Jesus landed and saw a large crowd, he had compassion on them and healed their sick. If it was me and I was trying to get away from the crowd and I turned around, there were 5,000 people, I don't think I would have been filled with compassion. I would have selfishly said, can you not give me 5 minutes? Can I just have 5 minutes to myself? But that's not Jesus, is it? So he's trying to get away. They follow him and he has compassion on them. As evening approached, the disciples came to him and said, this is a remote place and it's already getting late. Send the crowds away so they can go to the villages and buy themselves some food. Jesus replied, they do not need to go away. You give them something to eat. Maybe a little sidebar here. My mentor, William Lane, used to teach us, if you write anything down I say this week, write this down. Bill used to say, you should always work at the level of your own inadequacy. You should always work at the level of your own inadequacy. Bill said, don't just do what you're good at. Anybody can do that. He said, you should always be right on the edge so that if the Lord doesn't show up to help you, you will fail miserably. And that's exactly what Jesus is doing with the disciples here. There's 5,000 people here. He says, you give them something to eat. He's brought them to their own inadequacy, and they realize it. See, if the Lord doesn't show up and do something, they are going to fail miserably. And that's what Bill said. You should always, that's the spot you need to keep yourself. Because some people are very gifted, and they just kind of stay in their gifts. They think they are their gifts, and they do pretty well. But they never get on the edge. You know, they're so afraid to fail. Never get on the edge where the Lord shows up. And so I think that's what's going on there. And I agree with Bill because he was a pretty smart guy. So they don't need to go away. You give them something to eat. Here we have only five loaves of bread and two fish, they answered. Bring them here to me, he said. And he directed the people to sit down on the grass, taking loaves, the five loaves and the two fish, and looking up to heaven. When Jesus prays, he always looks up. I'm surprised the church hasn't copied him in that, because if there's a reference to him praying, his attitude in prayer, he always looks up when he prays. Maybe we should do that more. So he looks up to heaven. He gave thanks and broke the loaves. Did you miss it? He just fed 5,000 people from five loaves. Rumbling or finger, you know, lightning bolts from his fingertips? No. It's an unmiraculous miracle. He says the blessing. Then he gave them to the disciples, and the disciples gave them to the people. They all ate and were satisfied. And the disciples picked up 12 kophanoi. Completely different word. Okay? So the second feeding, spheros, man-sized basket. The first feeding, and there's seven of those, get this clear in your head, okay? In the feeding of the 5,000, there are 12 kophanoi. What's a kophanoi? It's a lunch basket. It's a little creel. It's about this big. You put a string through it, and you wear it over your shoulder. You put your lunch in there, okay? So the point of the second miracle was abundance. 7 man-sized baskets full of the leftovers. The point of the feeding of the first feeding of the 5,000, they pick up 12 little lunch pail sized baskets. What is that? Perfect provision. Is that not cool? Perfect provision. And you got to realize that is as much a miracle as abundance. The very first time I went to Israel, I was making videos with our daily bread on the life of Jesus. And I've been there 10 days, and they didn't pay me. Our deal was I get videos when I go on the road, and I sell those, and I make money. So believe me, I was making money. I was going to make money. I'm not a generous person. So anyway, Fred, who's the director of the videos, comes up to me towards the end, and he said, oh, well, first what happened is my wife calls. We live in the country. We have a well, and our well had broken down. We had a 600-foot deep well where we lived. Beautiful stainless steel pump at the bottom of this thing, and $1,200 it's going to cost, right? And we don't have $1,200. And she's got 3 kids in diapers toddling around. Well, I'm in the Regency in Jerusalem, you know, waiting for my seaweed wrap and my massage, and I'm not particularly worried that she doesn't have water, but of course she's pretty upset about it. So as I hang up the phone for my wife telling me what had happened, Fred knocks on the door, walks in, he says, I know our agreement is that we don't pay you, but we feel like we should pay you something. So he hands me a check for $1,200. Now, if that had been a check for $12 million, abundance, I wouldn't be here right now. I would be morbidly obese sitting in front of a big screen TV in Nashville channel surfing, because the Lord knows that's just the sort of person I am. But do you see that the one who created the universe knew that there was this woman down in Franklin, Tennessee, whose well wasn't working, and she had kids and, you know, laundry to do, and she needed $1,200. So in Israel, he moved somebody to write a check and hand it to me. That's perfect provision. And that's the point of the feeding of the 5,000. And it's all in the details. It's all in listening to the details. I want to look at one more passage and the details of that. Isn't that cool? I mean, it just kind of preaches itself. One, it's perfect provision, and the other, it's abundance. And that's why they're two feedings, two completely different miracles with two completely different outcomes in two completely different places. Now, you will read some scholars that will say there was only one and Matthew put it in the wrong place or whatever. Don't believe that for a minute, because you may not, well, I'm sure you do know this. Jesus recaps them for us in Mark 8. Mark 8, 18. Do you have eyes but fail to see and ears but fail to heal? And don't you remember when I broke the 5 loaves for the 5,000, how many kophanoi, the word is kophanoi, did you pick up? 12. And when I broke the 7 loaves for the 4,000, how many spheroi, big baskets, did you pick up? And they answered 7. So Jesus recaps the 2 miracles. So don't let those people rattle you. So the last thing I want to share with you from Matthew's gospel, the detail, is I refer to it as the simplicity of Jesus' end times vision. The simplicity of Jesus' end times vision. And we'll just read the passage. It sort of speaks for itself. I don't know how many of you are part of the Jesus movement. I'm very, very proud to have been a part of that movement. A lot of people have forgotten that it ever happened. But if you were part of that movement, you know that one of the confusions of the Jesus movement was everyone arguing about the end times, right? There are people that still argue about it. You know, the B-52s, the locusts are B-52 bombers, right? And so-and-so is the Antichrist. Whoever was the most popular politician at that time ended up being the Antichrist. And, of course, none of it ever happened. People were predicting, writing books about what year the world's going to come to an end. And it was so complicated and so divisive. And when I saw this, that when I saw the simplicity of Jesus' end-time teaching, it was a wonderful, wonderful thing. So I want to share that with you very quickly. And it's very simple. after he leaves the Temple Mount, and he's mad. Okay, he's mad. In your anger, sin not. You can be angry and not sin. So Jesus is angry, but he doesn't sin. Okay? So, and the disciples are making small talk. They say, look at these beautiful stones. And I think it makes them even madder. And he says, you see these stones? Not one stone's going to be left on top of the other. And I can take you to Jerusalem and show you those stones. There's a big pile of stones from where the Romans destroyed the temple. They broke it all up and they pushed it over the Temple Mount, and they're still there. There's a big pile of them there, okay? Which I think is pretty cool. So you see those stones, not one's going to be left on top of the other. So they walk across the Kidron Valley up to the Mount of Olives, and the disciples have been pretty upset about this, and they ask him, they think it's one question, but it's actually two questions. They say, when are these things going to happen? Question one. And what's going to be the sign of the coming of the end of the age? It's asked differently in different Gospels, but basically, and what's going to be the sign of the end of the world? Now, they think that's one question, because for them, the destruction of the temple is the end of the world. It's the end of their world. But what I want to show you is they ask two questions, and Jesus gives them two answers. Very simple. The first thing he describes in very worldly terms, and it's something you can run away from. And it's the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. Okay? Two answers. When are these things going to happen? And what's the sign of the coming of the end of the age? First answer is things you can run away from. Pray that your flight won't be in winter. Right? If you're on the rooftop, don't go down. You know, get the heck out of Dodge. And what actually happened is the Christians heard Jesus. They took this seriously. And when Titus, the army of Titus, was marching on Jerusalem, they fled to the city of Pella. And a lot of Christians survived the destruction of Jerusalem because they understood this. Okay, but then the second answer, the answer to the second question, he just describes something you can't run away from, the end of the world, his coming. You know, so see if it makes sense to you. And now, it doesn't answer all the questions, but if you're like me and you get upset when people start arguing about these things, I just say, you know, I just love the simplicity of Jesus' teaching on the end times. It's freeing. So let's see what you think. And I'll just read it to you. This is 24. Jesus left the temple and was walking away when his disciples came up to him to call his attention to its buildings. See, he's been there his whole life. He doesn't need to have the temple pointed out to him. Do you see these things? He asked. Truly, I tell you, not one stone here will be left on another. Everyone will be thrown down. That's exactly what happened. As Jesus was sitting on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately. Tell us, they said, one, when will this happen? Question one. And two, what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? Is that pretty clear? That's two questions. Okay. First question. Watch out that no one deceives you, for many will come in my name, claiming I am the Messiah, which happened. There were so many messianic pretenders before 70. There was one in particular that there was one guy that the rabbi said was the Messiah. Rabbi Akiva, I think, said, this guy is the Messiah. I forgot who it was. Used to know that stuff. Many will come claiming I'm the Messiah and will deceive many. You will hear of wars and rumors of wars. Now, every time there's a rumor of war, American Christians say, well, the end of the world is coming. Because didn't Jesus say there'll be wars and rumors of wars? This is Jesus' way of saying, when haven't there been wars and rumors of wars? That's not a sign of the coming of the end of the world. See, Jesus is saying there are going to be wars and rumors of wars. But see to it that you are not alarmed. Is this clarifying? Because I know people used to try to scare me all the time. Vietnam? Oh my goodness. It's the end of the world. No, there'll be wars and rumors of war. Don't be alarmed. Don't be alarmed. Such things must happen, but the end is still not to come. Nation will rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom. There will be famines and earthquakes in various places. All these are just the beginnings of the birth pangs. Then you will be handed over to be persecuted and put to death. You will be hated by all nations because of me. Every one of them except John were killed, were martyred for their faith. So that happened. At that time, many will turn away from the faith and will betray and hate each other. That happened. And many false prophets will appear and deceive many people. Because of the increase of wickedness, the love of most will grow cold. But he who stands firm to the end will be saved. And this gospel of the kingdom will be preached to the whole world as a testimony to the nations. And then the end will come. Answer the first question. So, when you see standing in the holy place the abomination that causes desolation, Titus sacrifices a pig in the Holy of Holies and causes the temple to become desolate. That's what Jesus is talking about. Stick with me. Spoken of through the prophet Daniel, let the reader understand. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. He's describing something you can run away from. You can't run away from the second coming, right? But the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 and the armies of Titus, when you see them coming, you better get the heck out of Dodge. Flee. And some did. Let no one on the housetop go down to take anything out of the house. Remember that. Because in verse 40, he's going to say, well, two people are going to be on the roof. One's going to be taken, the other left. He's describing something you can't run away from. Okay? Let no one in the field go back to get their clothes. How dreadful it will be in those days for pregnant women and nursing mothers, because they're running away, and it's really hard when you're pregnant to run away. Pray that your flight won't take place in winter or on the Sabbath. He's describing something you can run away from. Then there will be great distress, unequaled from the beginning of the world until now, and never to be equaled again. And if you were there for the destruction of Jerusalem, you would have said, yeah, this is the worst thing that ever happened. I'm gonna cut on down to verse 29, which is the second. It's when the second question begins to be answered. Immediately after that distress of those days, and now his language becomes apocalyptic. Before he's describing armies surrounding Jerusalem, running away, and that sort of thing. And now what does he say? The sun will be darkened. The moon will not give its light. The stars will fall from the sky. And the heavenly bodies will be shaking. No one, there's not going to be any question in anybody's mind about what's going on. This is question two. What are the signs of the coming at the end of the age? When will these things happen? The destruction of the temple. And what are the signs of the end of the coming of the age? Then will appear the sign of the Son of Man in heaven. And then all the peoples of the earth will mourn when they see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with great power and glory. And on it goes. I'm skipping down to verse 36. But about that day or hour, no one knows, not even the angels in heaven, nor the Son, but only the Father. As it was in the days of Noah, so it will be in the day of the coming of the Son of Man. Nobody saw it coming. For in the days before the flood, the people were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage. But up to the day Noah entered the ark, and they knew nothing about what would happen until the flood came and took them away. This is how it will be at the coming of the Son of Man. Here it is. Two men will be in the field. One will be taken and the other left. Nobody's running away from this. You get it? Does this make sense? No energy whatsoever. No energy. See, if you were beat to death by, you know, the people who were into this signs and stuff, this was so freeing to me. Oh, he's describing something you can't run away from, something you can't run away from. And right now, what are we waiting for? A trumpet, apocalyptic, and we'll be taken. So that's what we're waiting for, okay? Putin is not the Antichrist. Trust me on this one, right? So anyway, sorry, I'm being silly. Two men will be in the field, one will be taken, the other left. Two women will be grinding with a handmill, one will be taken, the other left. See, there are two women. It takes two people to grind a mill, and one of them's going to be gone all of a sudden. Okay? Therefore, keep watch, because you don't know what hour your Lord will come. But understand this, if the owner of the house had known what time night the thief was coming, he would have kept watch and would not have let the house be broken into. And here, I'm skipping down to 45. So here is the conclusion. This is the great freedom of this teaching. It's freeing us up from meticulously trying to figure out little signs. Jesus has not put that burden on you. He wants you to have one burden, and this is the burden. Verse 43. But then, who's the faithful and wise servant? So if you process all this stuff, what are you supposed to do? whom the master has put in charge of the servants in his household to give them their food at the proper time. It will be good for that servant whose master finds him doing so when he returns. That is the point and the freedom of this teaching. What does Jesus call as he's freed us up? We don't have to worry about the future, do we? You know, it's like a raw nerve about this COVID stuff and all the stuff that's going on in the world. Let me tell you, he's got it. He's got this, y'all. He's got this. And he's left us with one burden, and that's to love people well and to feed people with his word, with this gospel, with this good news that we have. And that's to me, that's the great freedom of the simplicity of Jesus' end time vision. You know, there's two questions and there's two answers. One thing you need to run away from, but that's already happened. And the other thing that you can't run away from. And boy, I don't want to run away from that one. So let me pray for you. Lord Jesus, thank you for your word and for the freedom it gives us. It always sets us free. And thank you that the burden we have is the burden to love well and to be obedient to your word. And so we pray that you would empower us and give us the grace to do that in your name, Jesus. Amen.